Ben Smith, I'm a photographer, and this is my podcast, A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers. Thanks for listening. Hello folks, this is Ben, this is my podcast, A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers. I know you probably already know that, but someone might have stumbled upon it. How's it going? I hope you are well. Welcome along to episode 51. Thank you very much for joining me. I'm delighted to welcome as my guest this week, the photographer and film director, Ian Derry. Before I introduce Ian properly, let me briefly do a bit of housekeeping. Regular listeners will know that this is the bit where I usually encourage you to leave a review on iTunes or to support the podcast with a small monthly recurring donation. I sometimes even advertise my services as a builder of Squarespace websites, at which point, of course, I am inundated with hundreds of reviews, hundreds of donations, dozens of web development commissions. Tumbleweed normally. But forget all that for now. I have a more important request. This week particularly, please, if you do like the podcast, take 30 seconds to vote for it in the British Podcast Awards. They have a special Listener's Choice Award. That's the one you're voting in. And all you have to do is go to the britishpodcastawards.com/vote. That's britishpodcastawards.com/vote. And if you would do that for me, I'll be hugely grateful. And thanks for those of you who have already done it. Also, this is just for British podcasts. So if you happen to like an American podcast or a podcast from another country, and that's your favourite, it doesn't matter, because this one is just the one that you vote for British podcasts. Does that make sense? I hope so. You know what I'm saying. It's for British podcasts. So if this is your favourite British podcast, please vote for it. That would be awesome. So Ian Derry started his career 35 years ago at the tender age of 15, when he embarked on an old school apprenticeship in regional newspaper photography, cutting his teeth in the early 80s during a huge national news story, the Falklands War. And from that solid and in many ways enviable foundation, there followed a natural and necessary move to London, where he immediately began working for the national press, both broadsheets and tabloids alike, as both a freelancer and a staff photographer, gaining a dizzying breadth of experience from hard news stories during the conflict in Bosnia to celebrity portraits, catwalk fashion shoots and everything in between. Ian then reinvented himself completely, moving away from the newspaper world and establishing himself as a top-flight portrait, advertising and commercial photographer, mainly focusing on A-list actors and celebrities and sport and fitness. His latest reinvention sees him transition from stills to the moving image. His second short film, Johanna, about Finnish world champion under-ice freediver Johanna Nordblad, was self-funded with the insurance payout from a serious cycling accident and has been a massive viral hit online with 15 million views and counting, kickstarting Ian's directing career and quickly earning him a place on the roster of film production company and directing agents Archer's Mark. So Ian's film Johanna popped up on my Facebook feed. I watched it and I thought it was amazing. Clearly I was not the only one given the 15 million views. And as soon as I established that its director was a London-based photographer with a long career behind him and an impressive body of work, I emailed him immediately, and happily, a few days later, we were recording the following chat, which I very much hope you enjoy. Here's Ian.
Stills generally for me is a day's shoot.
Right.
You know, sometimes it could be 4 or 5 days or 2 or 3 days, but invariably it's probably a 1 day shoot.
Mm.
So yeah, you go, you take the pictures, you come back.
Yeah.
And then the next day you might be editing or doing an invoice or, you know, whatever it is.
Yeah. So it's still a lot of time spent on your own in front of the blooming screen, basically, and sort of, you know,
too much.
Getting caught in your own head, I find, at least anyway, you know.
Yeah. Too much time spent on your own, actually. It's not good. It doesn't have a good effect on me, actually.
No, I think you're not alone.
And I didn't actually realise that until I came here. Once I started coming here.
And this is your basically your agent's office or your new...
Yeah,
directing agent. Video office. Agent, so, yeah.
And just being around creative people. You know, and I've only been here a few months. They're like my mates now.
Mm.
You know, so if I'm here on Friday, we'll all go for a beer after. Or, you know, I might be sat there and just come up with an idea. I've actually just come up with one. I can't sadly tell you about it yet because it's a long way off. but if it happens, it will be amazing. And I think that's really come about through sitting in this office, seeing their ambition and me thinking, right, well, I can upstage what's gone before because they are probably able to achieve it. If anyone can, they can.
Right.
So it's quite inspiring, actually.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah. It gives you encouragement. And yeah. And I think it's such a common issue. You know, I see people, I go to coffee shops and I see people sort of crowded around laptops, you know, like three or four people. And I'm thinking, wow, they're all working on the same thing. It must be so awesome to have that feeling that, you know, I'm not doing this all basically all on my own.
Yeah, yeah.
So thank you so much for talking to me. The reason I'm here is one of those fantastic little pieces of serendipity, but your film Johanna came up on my, I was indulged in my favorite activity, which is looking for displacement activity on Facebook, and there was your film, and so of course I clicked on it and watched it, and it was brilliant, I thought, and here we are chatting. So that's, I guess, the joy of my having this podcast. But we'll kind of come on to the video stuff later, because you are at heart a stills photographer and always have been. So let's just walk through it. How did you get started?
In 1980, I would say, I would have been 14. I was born in 66. So in 1980, my father gave me a camera.
Right.
He brought it back from Hong Kong. He was in the Navy. He brought it back from Hong Kong. He wasn't using it. It was, I think, a Helena something or other.
Oh, right. I had a Helena, I'm
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, something like that. It was like a rangefindery thing. Mm. And he gave it to me. He's like, do you like photography? I'd never thought about photography in my life. No, I liked seeing pictures. Wasn't, you know, that bothered. And I kind of... This is going to sound quite big-headed. I don't mean it to be, but I kind of could just do it.
Mm.
It's a bit like my son, who's really, really good at football. And when we gave him a football, he could just do it.
Right.
And, you know, I just picked it up. But I understood how to hold a camera, and even that sort of error that people make of trying to focus like this, I had my hand under the lens. Mm. And I enjoyed it. And I started to explore it. Like I always do. If I'm into something, I'm really into it. If I'm not, I'm really not interested.
Right, so you're a bit all or nothing.
Yeah, very much all or nothing, yeah. Perhaps that's not often a good thing, but, you know, it's just the way I am.
Yeah.
So I was still at school, obviously. I went to the Porchester Camera Club. Porchester's a little place between Southampton and Portsmouth. I was born in Southampton. Because my father was in the Navy, we moved near to Portsmouth.
Right.
Which is not good if you're a Southampton supporter going to school in Portsmouth. I went to camera club and we learned about processing, dark rooms, stuff like that. And then a little bit of time went by. People from my family were quite encouraging. My uncle was quite encouraging. And it got to 1982, so a couple of years later. And I was quite into it at this point. And we had a neighbour... lived opposite, lived in a little cul-de-sac. He lived across the way, and he was a photographer. And he used to work for a local newspaper, and he then had left there, and he started up a little news agency, like covering news and sport along the south coast for national publications that they didn't want to send from London to.
Hmm.
He said, I will introduce you. Oh, no, in fact, he took me to a football match at Fratton Park. Luckily, no one at that point knew I was a Southampton supporter. And I got some quite good pictures. On my first go, we pre-photoed with a 50mm, old school stuff, 50mm, I think it was a Canon camera, I can't remember. I focused on the penalty spot, and I got the shot of the guy coming up to head it, the ball in the back of the net. It was just, you know, there was no motor drive, it was just a click, but it was all there. And he said, look, you know what, maybe there's something in this, I don't know. And so it was a family favour. He introduced me to a guy in a local paper called Dave Lolly, who's sadly not with us anymore, but without him, I would not be, God knows where I'd be now. And I was introduced to him, and I was going to go there for 2 weeks. It was that period where it's just before your O levels then. So you're supposed to be working hard. I hated school. Absolutely hated
school.
Did
you?
Yeah.
Why?
It's just, I went to an awful school. I hated the place. I didn't hate the place I lived. I just felt like there was a bigger world out there. I didn't realise this at the time. But looking back on it, I can see from the things I've done since why I felt so penned in.
Yeah, yeah. Like there was something out there that you were missing out on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then I got introduced to Dave, and he was the picture editor of the local paper. And it was a big paper at that time. It was about 100,000, selling 100,000 a day.
Wow.
It was 6 days a week.
Yeah, like an evening.
Yeah, proper newspaper back in the day. So this is 82. I'm supposed to be studying. I start on 2 weeks work experience. I'm now addicted. Like my first day, I'm like, wow. You got journalists on typewriters. You've got, you know, the whole, it was like old school newsroom. It was like a film set as we'd now see
mm-hmm.
it. And I was shadowing other photographers, and they would take pictures, and they would all, without exception, would be really helpful, really encouraging. Dave would always, you know, at the end of the day, he'd sit down with me and he'd say, right, you know, you did well here, perhaps you could improve here. He was mentoring me. I don't know why he took me under his wing. He had two daughters, maybe he wanted a son, I don't know.
Maybe he saw the potential in you.
Yeah, maybe. It was early days though, you know, we're talking a couple of weeks.
Yeah, right.
And then the Falklands War was on. So Portsmouth was quite a definitive point in the Falklands War, like the ships going from Portsmouth, troops, planes, casualties we took, invariably those people had families in Portsmouth or surrounding areas. So the newspaper was stretched, I mean maxed out, covering all these things happening, especially when the war ended, because then you had all these ships coming back and all this euphoria. You know, we'd won the war. Well, you know, we just snuck through the war, but nevertheless, we won the war. And so then I started to, you know, at that point, the photographers were so busy doing these key moments in history, in a way, covering all this stuff, that there was no one to do the Lord Mayor's parlour, there was no one to do the golden weddings, there was no one to do all the rubbish.
Right.
So that was my job. You know, and I was still probably 15, actually. I wasn't 16 until the end of June.
Wow, so you're incredibly young.
Yeah, really young. I was having some problems at home. You know, my mum and dad got divorced. It's invariably probably not all about them. Probably part of it was me being I probably helped things. But anyway, I'd moved out of home. I was living on my own. I think I might even still have been 15 then, or 16.
And you're living on your own?
Yeah. And then this guy, Dave Lottie, like I said, he would literally encourage me, understand things. I was in a difficult place, but I had this, maybe like you say, this ability.
Attitude, at least.
Maybe, yeah. And if nothing else, I perhaps had an attitude, but I also had the right attitude.
Yeah, but aptitude as well.
Oh, aptitude, yeah. Maybe, yeah. I don't know. Like I said, I don't want to sound too big-headed about it. It was just thrown my way. My dad gave me a camera.
I think, you know, we do have, you know, I think that, you know, is a real thing, to have a kind of natural instinct for something, or a natural, you know, tendency towards it. So it doesn't sound at all big-headed if you say that.
So the Falklands was on. I was covering all these little jobs around town. And then things got really, really busy. Ships were coming back, like I said. Yeah, huge ships, like aircraft carriers, etc. And then they were like, okay, right, well, nothing else matters today. This ship is coming back from the Falklands to all these hundreds of thousands of people along the beach in the city. So we need extra photographers. So then I was thrust right into it. And right into the lion's den. So you had every broadcaster newspaper there on the quayside, and I was a part of it. And at that point, I really thought, wow, you know, this is where I want to be at. This is, I'd go home and I'd see it on the TV. I might see myself on the TV in the background, or, you know, then the next day I might get the biggest picture. You know, there was no real hierarchy. It was whoever had the best picture. You know, we had a chief photographer and stuff like that, but again, he was very encouraging. And so it kind of quickly developed, and then we reached a bit of a problem where it was quite unionized, as you probably know, back in those days. The NCTJ, National Council for Training of Journalists, kind of ran things. You had to have a certain amount of qualifications. I didn't. You had to have two A-levels. I mean, I'd only just gone through my O-levels, which I didn't even turn up for a couple because there was stuff to do. You know, there was photos to take.
Yeah, yeah.
So the NCTJ insists that I needed these qualifications. The newspaper were willing to back me and say, well, he hasn't got them, but he has come about. He has come about it from a different position, but he's nevertheless is qualified, we think, to be supported and not just given up on. So they came to this deal where there was a youth opportunities program. The paper paid some money towards it. The government paid some money towards it. I got paid £39 a week.
Right.
I remember that figure because I had to give my mother 15 of it.
Right.
I'd gone back to live at home at this point. Things had kind of got a bit better. This is later in the year.
Mm.
But they insisted that I did a GCE, or O-level, sorry, in English language and in maths. I didn't turn up for my English language or my maths the first time round. I'm not sure my father or my mother know that, actually. But anyway, there we are. It's a long way down the road now.
Yeah, they'll probably get over it.
So they said night school, you must go to night school and try to achieve these two GCSE O-levels, and we will then see where you're at in a year's time. Well, fast forward a year, I'm now involved in the newspaper. I'm regularly published stuff each day. My name is on it. Things are going well. How much interest do you think really I've got in sitting in the classroom in the evening?
Mm.
None. So foolishly, I get to the end of the year and they say, okay, cool. So how'd you get on with your O-levels? Failed, both. So now I'm in a situation where I've got all this experience under my belt. The paper want to keep me, but the NCTJ, I don't have the qualifications. Now, I don't know how, but sense seemed to prevail, and I was allowed to keep the job and go on to the NCTJ training scheme, where I did the 2 8-week block release courses in Sheffield at Richmond University, or Richmond College, which again I hated.
Right.
Because I'd had this amazing, you know, this amazing 18 months where...
You had the sort of perfect apprenticeship, really, in
really,
a way.
Yeah,
you were thrown
in at the, you know, I kind
the deep
of...
End.
To be there with the national papers and the international press, it was such a huge, and it was such a massive story at the time. And for it to be in Portsmouth, and, you know, we had so many editions. We had the first edition, the second edition, the slip edition, the later edition, a special edition. You know, it was like pictures, pictures, pictures. I couldn't get enough pictures. You couldn't take enough pictures.
Yeah.
You know, and then you were rushing back, and the stuff would go into the dark room, it would come out, and you'd have to go through, choose a negative, you know, and it would be printed really quick, and then before you on your way home, there's your picture on the front page. And
so it's very exciting at that age.
Addictive stuff, this.
Yeah. Well, any age is pretty exciting, but at that age, it must have felt amazing for you.
Dave was still the mentor that he'd always been. So I kind of stayed there for a few years, but I can't actually remember how many years, unfortunately. I think it was about 3 or 4. And then I felt it was time to move on. Obviously, by this time, I've got a car.
Hmm.
I'm more independent. I'm earning more money. I've been doing it a while. So then I went back to the neighbour that introduced me to the newspaper, Mike Walker. And I said, look, you know, I kind of want to move on now. You know, I want to get to London, basically. I wanted to work for national newspapers. And he was like a stepping stone between the two. So I went and worked for him for a couple of years. And then I thought, right, it's London for me then. Kind of outgrown where I lived. There was nowhere else really to go, you know, done the paper, done the, it was after that, what was it, what would it be, weddings, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So, not knocking weddings per se, but it just, you know, not it wasn't for me.
But you were immersed in the newspaper world, and that's where you wanted to be shooting.
I wanted to work for a national newspaper. I wanted to get on aeroplanes and see my name in national newspapers. So I got in the car, I took all my portfolio, I drove to News International because it was they had the most money I needed, and I knew them. I'd worked for The Sun quite a lot. You know, whatever you think about The Sun now, then it was a great newspaper. There might have been some other rubbish in it, but for news, it was always first.
Yeah.
And the Sunday Times, bizarrely, guy called Ray Wells was always very encouraging. And so I would come up and down to do shifts, shifts for the newspapers in London. You know, it might be a doorstep, or it might be a premiere of a film. You stood outside on your step ladder or whatever it was. And I was just spending more and more time in London. So I left the agency in Portsmouth, and I moved to London. And then I pretty much just freelanced for The Sun in the week. And at weekends, I shot football for the Sunday People. So, you know, the main games in London, whatever it was. And I did that for, I don't know, five or six years. You know, and like I said, you know, whatever you think about The Sun now, then they were first for news. If there was something happening or potentially happening, you were on the plane, you know, you were there invariably first or on your way first. Mm. And I did some, you know, I covered some really, really great news stories for them.
So you're having a proper training in the sort of, in the, like you say, the kind of cutting edge of the news business, as well as learning, you know, the ropes as a photographer.
Yeah. And seeing people like Calvin McKenzie, an absolute tyrant of a man, you know, I'm not going to get into what we think about him per se, but that era, to have worked in a newspaper office, watching him in that era was, you know, incredible. The pressure that he put on people, the effect that he had on people, you know, and the pressure that you felt to achieve really filtered down, you know, when it was quite an intense time, but also massively exciting time too.
Yeah, so did that give you a sort of work ethic that you were always going to push and push? Because I imagine having that experience early on, you know, kind of sets a trend for how you're going to operate in the future.
Well, I think you've either got a work ethic or not. I'd like to think I do. If I'm not thinking about what I'm doing, I'm probably thinking about what I'm doing next.
Yeah.
So I think I've got that. Mm. And I think those days, perhaps, I think the work ethic, to be honest, comes from working on a local paper.
Right.
Because, you know, when you've got people really rooting for you, and you've got so much respect for them, and for some reason they've got massive respect and want you to succeed, you have to work hard. You know, it's just a feeling of not wanting to let people down.
Yeah, you're sort of indebted to them in a way.
Yeah.
So you had a really kind of old school apprenticeship, almost idyllic, in the sense that you came across, there was various elements of serendipity. You had this neighbour, you had this amazing guy at the paper, you had all these people who were sort of, probably unbeknownst to you at the time, were sort of kind of steering you along your path. I suppose, you know, compensation for that fact that things at home were not particularly good. So I guess you had, on the one hand, you had disadvantages, on the other hand, you had these amazing opportunities.
Yeah, I guess, but I kind of think that perhaps the you know, the unhappiness at home, and perhaps living on my own for a while, meant that the only thing I really had was at that point, or felt like I had. You know, it's such a long time ago, but I remember that my one focus through that was the newspaper and the photography.
Yeah, exactly.
And that relationship I've had now with the camera, if you like, you know, that's 35 years old now. It's like a marriage. Mm. It's like, well, it's longer than any marriages I've had.
Yeah.
let's not go into that. But it is, you know, and it's had its ups, it's had its downs.
Yeah.
The technological aspect of it, from my first camera, Nikon F, Photomic Head, put some black and white film in it, through the new technology situation at the newspaper, where computers came in, colour printing came in, there was strikes, the NUJ versus the NGA. You know, people just don't understand this. It's like talking Cantonese now. If you talk to the Instagram generation about it, they just have no idea about it.
No, of course. And also that experience that you had is not one that would even be possible anymore.
No,
you know, the training that you had.
No, exactly.
Yeah.
And then working through from those cameras, you know, to where we are now with the digital and the incredible advancements in camera technology is another aspect of it. You know, it's been a great 35 years.
Well, I mean, looking at your work now, of course, you know, what is evident is that, you know, you are sort of what I would kind of describe as a kind of top-notch commercial photographer. The evidence of your kind of newspaper training is kind of not really visible anymore. So
no,
how did
no,
you
I'm
transition
away from that now?
You know, how did you make that transition, and what created the, you know, environment that made you want to switch? Because basically you became more of a portrait photographer.
Yeah, no, definitely. I got to a point where I was working on, I'd been offered a staff job on the Sunday People. I used to shoot sport for them, as I said.
Mm.
And at that point, staff jobs were thought to have been getting more and more scarce. So I looked at it and I thought, well, do you know what? It's the Sunday People. I didn't want to work for the Sunday People, but they assured me that I would be doing news stories and sport and proper features. I got there. I hated it. It was just awful. I come off the road from working, flying around the world, Europe for the Sun, covering proper news stories like Thatcher resigning, like John McCarthy coming back from, you know, captivity. We've been to some great places, done some great things. And now I was in this straitjacket at the People and I hated it. And they sent me to Bosnia to photograph the only proper news story they gave me, to photograph a woman called Sally Becker, who was called the Angel of Mostar, who was rescuing kids in like a thin-skinned ambulance. And I sat in the back of the ambulance with her and this child who had all these shrapnel injuries and a mum and a grandma with a basket of clothes. And I thought, I don't want to really do this anymore. I just want it. I want an easier. Not easier. I just felt like I didn't want to be flying around the world to these places, being just in these situations. And I thought, okay, I need to find a better way. While I was in Bosnia, I got a call from Ron Morgans, who's the picture editor of the Daily Mirror, about a job that was on the Daily Mirror. And I was like, wow, this could be my way out. Otherwise, I'd have just gone back to the Sun freelancing or whatever. I got the job and then started doing news stuff and feature stuff again like I'd done. And then they sent me to do catwalk. So London, Paris, Milan, catwalk. I started working with Ollie Picton-Jones, who was the fashion editor then. And we'd worked together doing the catwalk shows. And then I started doing a little bit of studio work with her. Like if the fashion photographer wasn't around, I could fill in.
Mm. So it's almost at this point you tried, you know, you had that kind of experience where you get to do everything.
Yeah.
You get to try everything.
Yeah.
You're going
and
from Bosnia
much had done it all. Yeah.
Doing kind of photojournalism to, you know, to that.
Yeah.
Do you think that stood you in good stead, having that breath?
I think it did. Yeah, I think it really did. I just got to a point, I think, where instead of photographing people walking down the street or instead of photographing celebrities, if you like, in a news situation, I wanted to get to a point where I was knocking on the door and they were saying, hello, you're coming in because you're doing a feature about them. It could be some new character in Corrie. And then, you know, you go and you do some nice shots of them and the journalist does an interview and it's pages 4 or 5 on, you know. So I started doing more and more of that. And then we did a couple of fashion trips. So I learned how to use daylight more. You know, it sounds ridiculous saying learn how to use daylight. There's daylight. But I'm talking about having scrims, having black drapes, having white polys, controlling daylight.
Right.
I was in the studio a lot. We had a studio at the Mirror, so I could go in and practice. You know, if I saw something I thought the lighting situation I wanted to use, I'd go in and I'd try it.
Right.
And it might work, it might not work.
So, yeah, because I wanted to ask you about how you learnt to light things. I mean, not daylight, but actually, you know, using artificial lights. Was it there where you got to experiment?
Yeah, it was there.
And it was very much trial and error kind of thing?
Yeah, but it was trial and error, but I kind of think it's pretty straightforward. You know, if you work back from the old school, if you work back from a key light, so your main light, and you work, so you get that to where you think, and then you think, right, we need clip light or need a reflector or we need some light on the background because it's a bit grey and it needs to be a bit whiter. I think it's pretty much common sense in a way.
Yeah, maybe, but
but yeah, we, you know, I essentially taught myself how to light through trial and error. And I had the luxury of the studio, which was upstairs from the news floor, and I could go up there and try things out.
Yeah, so in a way, you kind of had already laid the foundation for them moving into, you know, the kind of more high-end, more slick-looking, one-on-one sort of, you know, actors and celebs, which is now what you do a lot of.
Yeah, so I think that perhaps one of the turning points for me was I went to Paris to photograph David Bowie. They said to me, we've got an interview with David Bowie. You want to do it? Well, there's only one answer. Mm. And I went there and I knocked on his door. There was no PR. I knocked on his door at the George Sank Hotel. And he came to the door and he went, hello, I'm David Bowie. And I was like, hello, I'm Ian Derry. And we shook hands. And we had tea. I took photos. We talked. And at that point, I thought to myself, you know what? There's not enough of this type of thing in the mirror. I can't take the photography far in the mirror.
Yeah.
You know,
so I should sort of set the context for people who are, you know, my imaginary listener in Kansas City, but we're talking about the kind of tabloid newspapers in this country, which are, well, I think people know what that term means, even if they're not here, but, you know, they're the kind of papers which, you know, have a lot of kind of celebrity, you know, kind of gossip stuff, and they're not the kind of pictures where you're going to get
you can't spread your wings as a photographer.
Yeah, a good portrait.
You're just within the boundaries of the newspaper.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I photographed him, and I thought, you know what, it's kind of, I want to do more of this. It was just wasn't really a. I didn't sit and think about it for too long. I never do. So I thought, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to leave. And there was a Paul Weller song. I based it all on a Paul Weller song, which was called A Brand New Start. And it was just before 2000. And I thought, well, do you know what? That's me. A Brand New Start. That's what I want. And so I resigned. Didn't really give it any more thought than that. And in 2000, I was freelance. And not working at very high end. I was working for sort of TV mags and stuff. But I was enjoying it. You know, I just enjoy photography. I'm not too hung up about the negativity of the situation you're in. You know, I think there's always positives, and I might not have been photographing at that point the best person in the world, but I was still progressing for where I was stage before that.
You're making progress.
That was the most important. Yeah. Maybe slow progress, but, you know, I wouldn't change anything really. I've kind of looked back at all these things, and I hadn't really thought about them until you contacted me about doing this interview. I hadn't really thought about any of this.
Right.
I thought about this probably more today on the train here than I've thought about it in the last 35 years.
That's really interesting. Because, I mean, you know, it could be said that it might be, you know, it's better to just live your life than sort of spend your time ruminating on everything. And
but you
seem to have built a career in the very sort of, you know, in the truest sense of that word.
Well, I just think I'm a normal bloke who's able to operate a camera. There's no real airs and graces about me. I have good days, I have bad days. If you ask me to take a picture, I'll do the best I can for you. That's as much as I can say.
Right. Well, that's kind of modest way of putting it.
But you know, then I started working and photographing higher profile people. And then as soon as you start working for shooting higher profile people, then you start working for better publications. You know, and then there was some advertising stuff that came along, and it all kind of worked out really well, you know. And then I started doing some shoots for BAFTA, and one of my favourite ever shoots was for BAFTA, where we had to do a previous winner's portfolio, and we did London, New York, LA, and photographed like Gary Oldman, Warren Beatty, Jennifer Hudson.
So, you know,
Annette
very
Bening, Martin
high,
Scorsese.
Yeah, top A-listers.
Yeah.
And what was your first experience? I mean, how did you kind of manage that experience initially? Were you phased by it at all?
No, not really.
It's just another subject.
Yeah. I mean, the thing about the BAFTA thing, it was actually made quite easy for me because there was no theme, which in a way, I don't know, I think it was easier, but some people might think it was harder. There was no theme. We had these people, but we only had them for a very short amount, some of them for a very short amount of time. So my experience from newspapers enormously helped me. So for instance, Kenneth Branagh, we wanted a shot of Kenneth Branagh. But Kenneth Branagh couldn't do it for various reasons. And I was like, well, he's got to get from where he is. He was coming to BAFTA to do some talk. And I was like, he's got to get from where he is to BAFTA. So I'll get in a cab.
Right.
Get a shot of him.
So you're sort of thinking laterally. So
pretty much did that, yeah. And yeah. I think the fact that I'm able to lie is one thing, but the fact that I'm able to work fast is it comes from the newspaper. You know, news and sport, you need to know how to frame, focus, get the exposure, everything fast. There's points for second best there. So I think that really helped me with working in that way.
Mm, yeah, it seems to me that you had all the right tools because... So for some photographers, I mean, yeah, I find this as well. I'm kind of coming from a documentary background, and photographers who are used to having a studio and lighting and very much, you know, controlling everything, kind of panic when they've got a scenario where you're in the back of a cab with Kenneth Branagh, for instance, because they're not used to having to just deal with that. Whereas for me, that's kind of meat and drink to me. I'd much rather be in the back of a cab with Kenneth Branagh than in a studio full of lights, which conversely would intimidate me.
Yeah.
But you had both of those things.
Well, within that set, we did.
You had the experience in both, I mean, you know.
Yeah, yeah, I did. I had the experience in both. So we're able to... So the two things, that being able to light and being able to work fast.
And dealing with those kind of A-listers? Not an issue, really.
No, I don't think so. I mean... I just think they're like... They're normal people.
And they tend to be quite... professional.
I think everyone's professional.
Yeah,
there are a couple that aren't, but I think everyone's professional. I think if you treat everybody with respect and I think if you, I hate to say this, but I think if you do move fast and you're not procrastinating, and you know, I'd love to have more time, don't get me wrong, but I just don't think in the everyday life of these people and the way it works out, you have that much time.
Sure.
So you need to work pretty quick these days.
So the relationship with BAFTA sort of has been ongoing, really. How did that come about initially then?
Well, I used to shoot for the BBC. There was a lady called Jeanette Daly who worked in the picture publicity department. She left the BBC and she went to BAFTA to become the photography director. And I started shooting for them.
Right, so it's the old story, really. It's about contacts that you'd already had.
Yeah, definitely about contacts. That's the way she works.
Yeah, and as do most people.
As I do. You know, I get lots of emails from people saying, you know, and they're great, but invariably I will use the people that are recommended word of mouth
or
I've worked with before.
Yeah, of course. So it seems to me what you've got is a kind of specialism in the sense that You do sport and fitness.
Yep.
And you do kind of celebs and actors.
Yep.
So, you know, has it helped you in a way to have that niche? Not that it's that niche, because it's pretty broad within that, but has it helped your career in the sense that people, if they want a fitness picture, they think, Ian?
I don't know, actually. It's an interesting one, because I'm not sure if some people look at what I do and think, what does he do?
Yeah. Well, it is quite broad.
Because if you look at someone like, I don't know, there are certain photographers that they just take a picture, they just take the same picture of a different person.
Yeah.
My pictures are all different. Different
That's
circumstances,
true.
Different people, different situations. I mean, I'm working, you know, I'm busy.
Sure.
So it seems to be working.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I've got three children. When the two youngest were very small, I had a book of Polaroids of them, and a magazine saw them and loved them, and I started doing a couple of kid shoots, and then I ended up doing a lot of kid shoots, you know, if like you walk down the high street, like Marks and Spencer's,
yeah,
you know, you name it, I was shooting stuff for them. And it did, in the end, it was great money. This is the thing, commercial money, days and days of shoots,
yeah,
it's great from a financial point of view, but it drove me mental.
Yeah.
So I had to find another way. So I basically just dumped it again, like deciding to resign from the newspaper. I just dumped it, and I had to find something to fill the gap. That's when I did the health and fitness stroke sport bit, which did plug that gap.
So there again, it's interesting that you seem to have a talent for knowing when to bail. I think, you know.
I don't know if it's a talent.
Or
I think it's just a question of, I've had enough of it.
Yeah. Really. But some, not everyone would some people get sucked into the, you know, the path of least resistance and the path of most security. And if you're if you're earning good bread, it's easy to just go, well, I'm going to keep riding this gravy train. But you haven't really done that. You've very much kind of acted on, yeah, maybe on instinct or a sense of ambition, maybe. I don't know.
Well, I've never really thought, like I said, I've never really thought about any of this, if I'm honest. I've just made decisions as I've gone along, perhaps for better, perhaps for worse. And I've just got, you know, I think I just get to a point where I've just had enough of it.
Yeah. Now, you've kind of, the reason, as I said at the beginning, that I ended up here is that you've transitioned into video. How did that decision come about? Was it very considered, or was it, again, a sort of organic thing?
I'd always wanted to make films. Now, when I was doing the catwalk for the Mirror, as I was saying earlier, years ago, I was taking with me Super 8 camera often and shooting little sequences of stuff and models and backstage and things like that. But it was expensive in those days. You'd have to get it telecine'd and, you know, and it never really, I never really did much with it. And I still had this thing in my head where I thought, I still want to make this film. And then I did an advertising campaign for Fujitsu, and we did it with this amazing guy called Felix, who is a yogi.
Yeah, Felix Price.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I said to them, look, you should make a film of this. And they were like, no, don't worry about it. We'll just do some behind the scenes. And I was like, well, you know what? There's some good stuff here. I'll do it. So I went off and with my own money, and I did it myself.
So that, and that was only like 2015. That was quite recently, really.
Yeah, it wasn't long ago.
And had you already been experimenting with video on the DSLR? Or
No, not really.
Right.
I'm not really into that. Personally, I don't really want to touch the camera.
Right.
The Felix thing, I had a DOP, we had a sound man. It was just my idea, and I did the I got an assistant, and we did the lighting, and we just made the film, and then got an editor, and we put it together, and I gave it to Nowness, and we got like, I don't know, 350,000 views.
Wow.
Straight off. So, you know, it was quite a good start, really. And I thought at that point, well, I could see something in this. And I'd enjoyed the process of making it so much. It was like a breath of fresh air. Because I'd gone in on my own and I'd come out working with the DOP, working with the sound man, working with the sound designer, working with the guy that does the music, the editor. And I loved this collaborative feeling.
Mm.
So there we are. The film's done. Happy days. I then get... In fact, I think actually it might have been before, but essentially what happened is I got hit by a car. I was on my bike. We were on a training ride before a London to Paris event. It's our last ride, 1 mile from the end. Car turns right. I go straight into the side of it, through his window, come out, smash my collarbone to pieces, my ribs are broken.
You went through the side window?
Yeah.
Jesus.
Yeah. And so there I am laying on the road. Ambulance comes along. Pin my shoulder back together. I'm in hospital for a while and I'm off work for 3 months.
Right.
Long, miserable, depressing 3 months.
Mm.
And in that time, I got an email from a lady who is the sister of Johanna, the freediver, about a set of pictures I'd done before of another freediver. And she said, is there anything in this which will interest you? And I was like, not really.
Okay, so she'd seen the stills you'd done. You'd already done some pictures of still. So yeah. She'd seen those, and that's what led her to contact you.
Yeah, she said she's a world record under ice. So any value in that? I was sitting there on the sofa thinking, no, I don't think so, really. But it was subliminally in my head. Anyway, so fast forward a bit more. I've come back to work now. Insurance claims gone in. I get a load of money because of the accident.
Right.
Not enough money. But nevertheless, I had a lump sum of money. And I thought to myself, what do I do with this money, which is not just squander it on holidays or, you know, I wanted to do something with it.
Mm.
And I thought, right, this is it. This is the time when I'm going to make a film. So again, it wasn't like most of my decisions, they're not really calculated decisions. They're just like, you know, well, let's make a film. We've got some money, let's make a film. You know, I had a tax bill. I had, like everyone. But I was a bit like, well, you know, let's make the film. It's going to be great. And I always wanted to do it. Let's see how we go. So I flew to Finland and met Johanna and met her sister, Elena. We got in a green van. They drove me 2 hours to this wilderness. We walked onto this huge expanse of snow, which was actually a frozen lake. So you got the snow on top of the ice. We walked on, and it was the most incredible, incredible place I've ever been. She cut a triangle in the ice. She gave me a dry suit. I put a dry suit on. I jumped in the hole with a rope around my wrist so they didn't lose me. And once I'd seen underneath that ice, I was like, we have to make this film.
Right. So it was instantaneous.
Instant.
You were kind of blown away by it. Yeah. Were you not slightly scared to do that?
No, not really. I mean, I've done freediving myself.
Oh, you have?
So, and I'm a scuba diver.
Okay.
I've done freediving myself. I've never done anything as extreme as that.
But you'd had some experience.
Yeah, I'm quite comfortable in water, underwater.
Right.
And I came home and I thought, right, I really, really want to make this film. But I have to say that something inside me did switch from, you know, I think what happens is you concentrate, you have to work quite hard these days, I think, in order to keep going. Because there's so many people here now. There's so many saturated with so many different photographers, etc. And I think my focus was diverted to Johanna from wanting to make the film because I'd seen the beautiful place, from wanting to always make a film because that's what I'd wanted to do years ago. So also, it just diverted my brain from what I've been doing for 35 years, and it was like a breath of fresh air,
right,
if
yeah.
I'm honest.
Yeah, change is as good as a rest.
Yeah, really. And, you know, a lot of people say to me, well, why are you not a DOP? Oh, I don't want to be a DOP. I know nothing about video cameras, you know. I want to direct.
Yeah. I can see that because, yeah, you know, with still photography, you really get to be in charge of everything, and, you know, you're behind the camera yourself. I mean, yeah, sure, you don't have to be, but, you know, but with that, yeah, it's a very different thing. You're collaborating with other people. It's very special. You were using very high-end kit.
Yeah.
Could you have made something that looked as great as that on a 5D or something, though, do you think?
No, I think it was almost a statement of intent. I left that lake and I thought to myself, if I want to be respected as a filmmaker, I need to make this film properly. So, you know, if someone said to me, we want you to do a still shoot, and they don't have the budget for this, they don't have, you know, the budget for that. And as my mother would say, they've got Rolls Royce ideas on push bike money.
Yeah.
You almost walk into a project thinking, well, do you know what? If they can't raise enough money for it, then, you know, I'll do my best, but there we are. Let's see.
Mm.
So I thought, I need to do this project properly. I had a 5D Mark III, and I got the underwater housing, and I've done a dry suit course. I could have done it myself, but I didn't want to operate the camera, as I said. I just wanted to direct the film. So we found the best DOP we could, who had a Sony F5 and a Gates housing, so we could shoot raw. I wanted to shoot raw.
So the kit comes with the cinematographer, as it were.
With him, yeah.
Yeah, you don't have to.
It's so specific, the underwater kit. Yeah, right. And then once I got to the lake, I realised we needed a drone. So we had a Red Dragon on that. I think if you try to do that on a Canon, it just wouldn't be the same.
Mm.
You know, and you had all that white and the black.
Yeah. And I hope people will, you know, go and look at the film so they know what the hell we're talking about. It's only a 4-minute film, but then it has occurred to me that, you know, the amount of money that it costs to make a 4-minute film is probably just as much as it costs to make a 30-minute film, right? The expense is not...
It's expensive. Yeah, you know, it's expensive.
So in terms of... You funded this one from your accident.
Yeah.
But what's the model going forward? How does one fund such an expensive endeavour?
Well, I've been lucky now because after Johanna, I got approached by... After Johanna first went out on Nowness, and it just got view after view after view after view and share after share, then it became a Vimeo staff pick.
Right.
And then National Geographic shared it to like 40 million followers.
Wow.
So then it was a global... In fact, National Geographic have just reshared it only a week ago, a revised version of it. And in 8 days, it's got over 12 million views.
Wow. So it's really gone viral.
Yeah, it's gone mental.
And you could never have anticipated that happening.
No, I could never in my wildest dreams. So what happened once it first went out is I had six directing agents approach me. And I was really quite flattered, really quite stunned. I was thinking, well, I've made this first film, Felix, which was all right, and then now I've made this.
It's only
this
your other second,
one, which is nice, you know. But I wasn't anticipating this really. And I went and met them all, and there were some I liked more than others, and I narrowed it down to three, and then I chose one, a company called Archer's Mark, which are BAFTA nominated for a film they made called Notes on Blindness. And now they've kind of taken over.
Mm.
So ideas that I have now, I don't have to put my hand in my pocket or get hit by a car. They look at the idea. They think, is that possible? Is that feasible? Is that interesting? If they believe in it, then they try and go and get funding for it.
So they're acting as producers, really, as agents.
The thing is what they are is they're a film production company.
Oh, okay.
And within that, they represent directors as well.
So, it's the full package.
Everything is there.
Right.
So there's editing suites, grading suites,
right.
producers, you name it, they've got it.
Okay.
So now I'm under this big umbrella. So what I need to do now is come up with ideas. And we go to companies and we convince them that they should be making these films.
Right.
They also get commissions. I've just done a commission for Versace. It's a very, very different type of film to Johanna, but it's commissioned work with a client. So. Mm. You can put a certain amount of your footprint on it.
Yeah.
The client ultimately wants a certain look for their brand.
So I just want to take you back to the two films that you made, because there must have been some kind of a learning curve there. I mean, directing for video is very different. It's the same in certain ways, you know, in terms of composition and everything, but it's a very different undertaking to shooting stills. How did you go about learning the ropes, or was it all just instinctive?
Instinctive.
Right. And like, for instance, with Johanna, did you storyboard the shots carefully in advance, so you knew exactly what was going to...
I did exactly that.
Right.
So in my head, Johanna was interesting, because Johanna was an underwater film. As soon as I got to the lake, I realised that I had to rewrite it. It was about her journey to the lake, because the lake was so beautiful.
Right.
Then I had to rewrite the film. But then it kind of almost wrote itself. You know, she's got this journey where she has to start somewhere, and you've got the view of the lake, and then she comes through and you've got the shot from above, and then she goes onto the snow, and then she cuts the hole. So it kind of chronologically worked. I wrote out each shot. I found a storyboarder. We properly drew it.
Okay.
And we pretty much nailed. I mean, I didn't mean for the DOP to take it as literally as he did, but we pretty much nailed it, actually. So
all just, you know, was planned out.
Yeah.
You've got this amazing drone shot. And I think, you know, drones have become a bit of a gimmick for a lot of people, because they're accessible to people. But this was absolutely integral to the film that you made, I think, having the drone.
Yeah, it had to be.
And there was a shot. There's literally a little forest and then this lake. And she's going through the trees, and the drone shots from above. It's a beautiful
scene. It was amazing. And that's the first time we'd seen it. We didn't know what that lake looked like from up there. And then as soon as we were on the monitor, stood on the lake looking at the monitor, and the camera had gone up, and there's this huge whir and snow everywhere, and it got above the trees. And we were all like, fuck, look at that. You know, I mean, look, actually, I've literally, the hairs on my arm is sticking up now. Right. We were all like, wow.
Yeah.
And I think at that point I knew that we were going in the right direction.
I wonder what it is that attracts people. You know, it's the old story, and you know, no one really knows what anything, as William Goldman said about the movie business. But the way in which things now grab people's imagination online, and like you say, you're competing with all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
But your thing's gone, you know, to 12 million views or something. What do you think it is? Is it the story, or a combination of things?
I think it's a combination of things.
Yeah.
And I don't think there's many other, there's not a lot of things like it either. I think it's the right length. I think the story is interesting. I think it visually just keeps you motivated. I think it would be very hard to keep you interested if that was 3.5 minutes, 3 minutes 45 of just above the surface. I think it'd be very difficult to motivate you if it was 3.5 minutes below the surface. But you put the two together, And it's almost like two films.
Yeah.
And the way the narrative changes, the way the narrative flows and the way the music changes, I think it just manages to keep you engaged every stage along the way.
Sure.
And I think the reason for that is not all down to me, as much as I would like, as much as I'd like to say it was. I had a guy called Howie Saunders who wrote the music for that. You know, you look at that film without the music.
Yeah.
It's not the same film.
Music is incredibly important.
You know that. A guy at White, he's left White House Post now, called Joe Walton, who did the editing.
So it's a real collaboration when you're shooting video.
A real collaboration.
And you really are reliant on the kind of, you know, you're only really as strong as your weakest link, I suppose, in a way.
And which actually, I find it harder now on a still shoot, because on a still shoot you're doing everything. You're pretty, you know, the art directors, and don't really art direct so much these days. They're interested in the first two shots. Often people don't even edit these days. So you leave there thinking, okay, we've just done all that. You've cajoled everybody through. You've kept the shoot going. All your energy is to keep it going, and you take some pictures. All of a sudden, all your energy is focusing on the one thing you should be doing. And you've got all these other people. We did a shoot the other day, the Versace shoot I was just talking about. We had a I had a first AD. I didn't even have to talk. I just had to look at a monitor. We had the camera on a Movi rig. He had a focus puller. He had three camera assistants. We had location people. Every single person had a role.
Yeah.
No one was having to cover somebody else. Every single person had a role.
And they're very clearly defined.
Very clearly defined.
I mean, I've seen this working, shooting stills on, on film shoots, and it's fantastic to watch.
It's fantastic. It's addictive. And I think looking at it, you know, I was quite critical of how much money gets spent on film sets at times, because I was thinking, wow, do they really need all this? But actually, you know, if you want to do something properly, then it's not even the money thing. Just have, you just need, each person just needs to clearly have their role identified. And then they concentrate on that one single thing. And then you come into post, and then you've got sound design, editing, music. You've got all the many layers.
You can see why it turns out to be so incredibly expensive, right?
Yeah,
and you
exactly
can suddenly
that.
See why movies cost $100 million.
For sure, but also incredibly addictive.
Yeah, and but I guess the thing we've kind of glossed over, which is possibly the most important thing, is that you know, it's a story about overcoming adversity to some extent. Tell us about Johanna.
Johanna is a mum. She's got a 15-year-old child. She's a normal person. She's a graphic designer. She's did free diving before. Then she had an accident on a bike, and she had awful injuries, and they thought she'd have to lose the leg, as the film says. And then she started this cold water treatment and started immersing the leg. Initially didn't like it, got easier. And then she's of quite an addictive nature. So then she started immersing herself. Then one thing led to another. And, you know, she's a bit like me, actually. She's a bit all or nothing.
Sounds like it.
She don't want to do it. She's just, you're not going to get her to do it.
Yeah, so but she's clearly not, you know, ordinary in most respects, and given what she now does. But all of that came out of this terrible accident she'd had. And now she's, you know, this, I think, world champion. For under ice diving. But so really, as a you know, it's that got that human interest thing at the heart of it.
Yeah.
It's not just a thing that looks nice, because there's lots of stuff that looks nice.
But that's the thing. I think it has to have a story. You know, you can make pretty pictures. I'm not knocking people that call themselves directors per se, but I do know people that call themselves directors that essentially stills photographers doing some video of a still shoot and putting music over the top. I don't really see that as directing. I think this, you know, you could criticize me, it doesn't have dialogue, talking dialogue, but it does have a narrative. And I think that's perhaps what the interest of the film was. She has an interesting story. If you put the three things together, if it was just beautiful to look at, so what? But you need that. If you didn't have the narrative, well, what's it about?
Yeah, what's the point?
And then if you didn't have the music, to that third layer, then that third, that when you get, you know, in any situation, when you get words and pictures When you get music and pictures together, it's a powerful thing. So you've got that with the the interesting narrative over the top. You've got yourself a film. I don't think this is necessarily brain surgery. I think sometimes people perhaps. The thing about the film, I would say, is the story came first.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
You know, the story came first, and then we worked back from there. If there was no story, there's no point in my opinion.
But I think, you know, you've really kind of hit upon the most important lesson of our times, really, whether you're working in stills or video. And it comes up a lot, and maybe I sort of fixate on it to some extent, or at least I refer to it quite a lot in the podcast. What should photographers who are, you know, sitting there with their 5D Mark IV, who haven't pressed that video button yet, what should they do if they are interested in experimenting with doing the moving image thing?
Well, I think you've got lots of outlets these days. You know, Nowness I talked about a lot, but they're very good. If you've got an interest in film, they've got good connections.
What are they?
Nowness is just
a hosting website.
You submit videos to them, and they will look at them, and they may put them out, or they may not. Or if they really like them, they can commission as well. So they've commissioned me to make films as well as me, because Johanna, I just gave them Johanna to get exposure. But I think the key to it is not to get too hung up. I know that I said on my film I wanted to have the highest quality, but we were in extreme situations, and I thought that was an important part. I think generally speaking, it's all about the story. If you come up with a story, I think you can shoot it on a 5D. I think you can shoot it on pretty much what you want. If it's an interesting story, it will always be engaging. You know, it's funny how very, very, very few people have asked me what we shot that film on.
Sure.
They've just accepted it as a good film.
Yeah, who cares, you know? Right?
And I think that's the same for my photography career. If you've ever got a great picture, no one's ever said, "Oh, is that Canon or is that Nikon?"
Yeah, it's not the point.
It's not the point. And I think, but come up with a story. If you don't have a story, you don't have anything.
Yeah,
it might be beautiful, great, but it's not going to engage an audience for long, unless it's got a story, I think. So yeah, you know, just keep thinking.
Yeah,
reading, looking at things, going places.
Do you come up with a lot of ideas for yourself?
Yeah, I do now.
Right.
I wasn't.
Is that, you know, is there any way of, you know, kind of setting about deciding to make that happen, to deciding to have ideas?
No, I think it's like writer's block, or, you know, a musician who gets stuck. I don't think there is. I think you just need to get yourself in a positive environment. I think if you're in a negative one, it's very hard to work your way out. Maybe have a break from it. It's not easy to do. I know everyone needs to earn money. Have a break from it. Go and do something else. Pick up a video camera, maybe. Go and do something else and see if you can get some interest going in it.
And going forward for you, what's going to be your sort of, you know, your perfect working life? Will you always continue to shoot stills, or do you think the video is going to take over, you know, in a perfect world? Well, again, you haven't really thought about it. You haven't thought about it.
I haven't, actually.
No. It's good. I think there's a lot to be gained from your approach.
Right now, and like I said, I'm a bit all or nothing. Right now, this is going really well. There's a couple of things potentially in the pipeline, which if they come off, will be mind-blowing for the amount of time I've been doing this.
Yeah.
But that's down to Archer's Mark. They're just great.
But also the quality of Johanna, and the fact that you wanted it to be, you know, as good as it could possibly be. And I think that, you know, that's paid dividends, because that was your calling card in a way.
Yeah, but that, you know, the thing about Johanna is I had to take a big leap of faith on that, because, you know, I put £5,000 away for that film, thinking, well, look at me, I got £5,000, I'm gonna make a film, aren't I good? £18,000 later,
yeah.
You know, my wife doesn't know that, so maybe I shouldn't have said it, but there we are.
Too late.
That's the truth. But we're reaping the benefits now. But I think you do need to put yourself out. Maybe you don't need to put yourself out £18,000. But you can't just sit there, wait for the phone to ring. You can't just sit there thinking, I'm not very creative. You know, I've been doing this job for 35 years now, and I think I'm the most enthused, albeit a different genre. I think I'm the most enthused, apart from when I was 16 years old, getting my name in the paper for the first time way back then. I've been in a long time, you know, and that's just from searching out different things.
Yeah. It's so good to know. It's good to hear. Ian, thanks so much. It's been a pleasure talking. You know, a few days ago, there I was watching Johanna on Facebook, and here we are chatting. That's the joy of it, and for me. So I really appreciate the time you've taken to talk. It's been great.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you asking me.